direction. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chin wag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today, I've caught Moira Creedon. Like a walking library of strategic finance, only much less terrifying and way more fun to talk to, Moira is pretty much the smartest person we've ever met. We could easily squander a quarter of the episode simply listing her accomplishments, but the short version is that she is one of the world's leading financial strategists and teachers, enlightening money-minded students and organizations all over the world. The list of educational institutions she has taught at, including Fontainebleau, IESE Barcelona, UCC, the University of Maynooth, the IMI, and of course, the mini MBA, makes your own 2-2 in sports science from Derby look suitably underwhelming. And as if all of that wasn't enough to make her one of the most respected, renowned, and remarkable thinkers in her field, she also delivers her lectures in English, Spanish, French, and German. What's the Spanish, French, and German word for crikey? Moira says, think of your CFO as you think of your customer. Understand them, their pain and goals, and mirror their language. Use your marketing hat to understand your stakeholder. Welcome to the show, Moira.
Thank you very much, Giles. Hard to live up to all that. I'll do my best.
I doubt that. Right, seven quick fires. Dublin or Barcelona?
That's a toughie, actually. When I lived in Barcelona, it's the only place I've lived abroad where I really felt at home. Landing back into Barcelona airport every time, I remember having that feeling like, oh my God, this feels like literally coming back into Dublin. But if I'm honest, at this stage of my life, I feel deeply privileged to live outside Dublin in a small village on the sea. So right now, Dublin.
Lovely. Well answered. Number two, Jeff Bezos or Jack Welch?
Another interesting question. If I'm perfectly honest, I wouldn't particularly admire either. I found Jack Welch fascinating, and I did have the privilege of meeting him a couple of times, as it happens. I'm not sure I would subscribe to his philosophy of management at all. And
okay.
Don't get me started on the subject of Jeff Bezos, because it's a bit too early in the morning to be using performance.
Okay. Nice. That's good. Knowledge or capital?
Knowledge, definitely.
Nice, easy. This is a nod to the mini MBA program that you take the two modules on. Traffic jams or speed cameras?
Well, thank God for technology nowadays that tells me where the speed cameras are and the traffic jams as it happens. I hate both. And I remember when I lived in Switzerland and back in the day when I was very much mainstream finance and had a very cushy overpaid job, as you do in corporate finance. And I remember my single biggest expense was speed tickets. And I developed a deep loathing of speed cameras. So on balance, I'll take traffic jams.
Amazing. Number five, gut instinct or analytical thinking?
That's a really interesting question. My answer will be, I think the dichotomy of either or, I think, is wrong. I think all good managers can do both.
Mm-hmm. Number six, fluent in finance or best friends with the CFO?
Wow, that's a really good question. I'm obviously wondering, can you be best friends with the CFO without being fluent in finance? And the answer is probably yes, because good CFOs should be able to speak English, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say best friends with the CFO, and as a result, you know what, you're probably going to pick up a lot of the jargon and terminology as you're just hanging out with them.
Nice. Yeah, we'll unpack that in a bit, I'm sure. And the last one, mini MBA or big MBA?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. And again, you know, I did the big MBA at the time, and I think it depends very much where you are in your career. And I'm often asked, because I teach a lot of students from relatively early in their career right through to, I'm very lucky that I get to teach people who are in there, even in their 70s. And I've even been teaching somebody recently who was in their 80s, because I teach a lot of entrepreneurs and I teach a lot of very senior managers and I teach people at board level. And people often ask me, should I go back and do a full bells and whistles MBA? I think when you're at an early stage of your career, a full MBA can be genuinely totally transformational. it's less about the content that you learn and more about a genuinely transformational experience in terms of who you meet, where you live, how you think, how you project yourself, your confidence. For me, it was utterly transformational. I think if you're already quite experienced, so if you're already a senior marketeer or whatever function you're in, I would say mini MBA, which is a very kind of disciplined, well-designed, really carefully thought through, what is it that you need to know and understand when you've already been out there doing, you know, real stuff in industry, making big decisions, etc. So I think it depends.
Cool. Good. They were very diplomatically answered. I don't think we've upset anyone there. So we must try harder. Thank you for joining us, Moira, firstly. To start the show, we ask every guest about their path to where they are now. I've had a sneak preview, obviously, and there's a lot there that we could dive into. But can you start by telling our audience about your first ever job and then what you regard to be your first proper job?
I think this really touches on why I agreed to do this podcast in the first place, because to be honest, when I looked at the sort of people you get to talk, and a lot of them are marketeers, and there was a sense of, who am I and who are these people? But as soon as I listened to the people you've interviewed, I really felt part of a community of complete oddballs, because most people have taken a rather roundabout route to where they are. And I think I definitely fall into that category. Early jobs, a lot of summer jobs. In my generation, nobody had any money. We were all broke. And there was no such thing as backpacking around in the summer. What you did was you worked. And I did everything from, I ran a small cinema on an island off the north coast of Germany through to working on farms all over Holland, worked in Central America. All summer jobs needed money. I do vividly remember my first experience of that entrepreneurial buzz, which was, I was about 18, I'd say, in France, and I was still a student. We set up an events company, and we ran, myself and still a very close friend, ran only about 9 big events over the course of a winter in France. And we did everything. We did everything from seeing the gap, realizing, oh, nobody else is doing this. And we had done some similar work in Ireland, and hiring venues with checks that would have bounced if they hadn't been cashed 3 days later. So we literally had 2 days to make our money back, doing all of the publicity ourselves, and then running an event with that absolute nervousness of, is anybody going to show up? And our very first event, we had about 700 people, which, you know, considering this was hand-printed flyers back in the day, was pretty good going. And that buzz, that absolute addictive adrenaline buzz of running your own little business and making something happen that otherwise didn't exist.
What type of events were these, Moira?
We ran, the first one was a soirée irlandaise, where we brought in a band and had a ceilidh all night, and we were serving Irish coffees at about 4 o'clock in the morning. My most vivid memory of that particular one, apart from the initial nervousness of, you know, it's 10 o'clock in the evening and there's nobody here, and then suddenly being completely overwhelmed at about 11:30. But my next clear memory is dancing in the snow the following morning at 10 o'clock in the morning. Let's just say we were barred from that venue ever after. I think we were barred from every single solitary venue we ever used.
Wonderful. Amazing. And so you presumably you were a young adult.
I was only about 18, 19 when we did all that. So I definitely had an entrepreneurial tendency. And when was very much in sales and marketing after college, you know, did a completely irrelevant degree in college, as you do, pure mathematics, no idea what that was about. And because I'm very much a people person, and went straight into sales and marketing jobs, which included some fairly wacky stuff, working in abattoirs all over the country. You give it to me, I'll sell it type attitude. Set up a business in Madrid, again, very young. And it's only really as I kind of moved into my 20s and did that full bells and whistles MBA, I realized that finance, which until then I had regarded as the most boring topic in the world. Sure, look, you know, I know we're making money. What more do I need to know? I was really privileged on that MBA. I met some really cool people who really inspired me in terms of how important finance is, and suddenly found myself liking it, in fact, even loving it. And then my first, I would say, real job was in General Motors, probably sometime in my kind of late-ish 20s after the MBA. And I was, again, I realize in retrospect, I was incredibly lucky, because let's face it, some finance jobs are incredibly boring. And I started in a very routine job and I was bored out of my brains. And at the time, General Motors was expanding all over the world. And I got catapulted by accident into negotiating a fairly messy deal in Greece, where two other people had been down there and failed to agree a deal. And I'm still only about 27 at this point. So they sent me down, closed a deal pretty quickly, and then was put on a plane to everywhere from China to Brazil to Russia, got into negotiating big deals. And I think it's then that I realized, like, yeah, I love finance, but the bit that I really like is people. And that was a segue into investment banking, because I got the kind of big corporate finance deal making experience in GM, which is kind of touching on one of your earlier questions, was a great combination of being able to do the analytical piece. I could model in my sleep. That bit I somehow found incredibly easy. But that's not really what it's about. It's about reading a room. It's about reading people. It's about trying to figure out, you know, how desperate are these people to close a deal? How much time pressure are they under? Who's putting them under pressure? It's all of that stuff. It's very much your people skills and your gut instinct in terms of where this is going. And I was incredibly lucky to do a lot of that work for General Motors under a man who was an absolute all day, every day masterclass of negotiation and pretty much taught me everything I need to know from that combination of very, very calm analytical skills through to throwing theatrics when he needed to throw theatrics. And he was so believable when he would storm out of a room and just brilliant at closing.
One observation I've made already, I think we're probably only about 10 minutes in, given I babble on for the first few minutes of each episode. We've already mentioned, I think it's Germany, Holland, France, Spain. I'm sure you mentioned Madrid, China, Brazil, Russia. You sound extraordinarily well traveled.
Yeah, I traveled to a fairly bonkers extent, for want of a better word, right up to the beginning of COVID. And even though, you know, my other half isn't necessarily always terribly happy with it, I still travel. But COVID made me reflect long and hard. But like, to give you an indication of, I set up my own business 20 years ago. So the early travel was much easier because you're working for a big corporate and you're backed by the big corporate. And if anything goes wrong, you know, I subsequently worked for the World Bank. I was working all over Sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, Southeast Asia. But if anything goes wrong, you know, you have the World Bank behind you and they'll pull you out. When I set up my own business 20 years ago, I still continued to travel quite insanely. I had, naturally enough, I had contacts all over the world at that point. And I was doing things like, you know, 7-country tours of the Middle East, which would include Syria and Iran on my own. And that was quite nerve-wracking at times. I was occasionally thrown into cells in places like Mozambique and Iran for the most trivial reasons, which effectively amounted to woman on her own traveling and therefore a vulnerable target to the likes of security forces in certain countries. So when COVID came, when it hit hard here in March 2020, I had a diary lined up of trips all over the world for the following few months. The previous year, I counted, I lectured in 39 countries in 2019. And I would have been doing the same thing in 2020. And of course, the musical chairs abruptly stopped because there were no flights. And I had to think long and hard. I was very lucky. Initially, I thought, oh, that's the end of the business. But the phone started hopping immediately for work that I could do online. But it also made me really think long and hard about my kind of values at this stage of my life and my lifestyle aspirations at this stage of my life. So I've completely given up the crazy stuff, which involves getting arrested in developing economies. And now I still lecture a lot in mostly Paris.
I don't know, rightly or wrongly, it's probably wrongly. I always try and work out some sort of logic between someone's kind of early school / college / university, whichever route people go, years, and where they, you know, latterly end up. Not for any real reason other than I think it's, you know, very human to try and work out the kind of rational reason why someone is where they are. But I wonder if it was just the travel and the experiences of so many people and types of business that have really shaped you more so than any aspirations as someone heading into a pure mathematics degree.
Yeah, it is always a fascinating question, because we're all a fairly complex combination of our parents' values, what our siblings did, what school we went to. I did go to a reasonably interesting school, non-fee paying, but I was educated through the Irish language, which meant that I suppose I was bilingual from the age of 3 or 4. And I think that simple experience of realizing that you can completely live the world through two different languages was already opens up your mind a bit. And I do notice that people from my school seem to travel a completely inordinate amount. I was also lucky that my mother had traveled a lot when she was young and prioritized that for me. So she sent me on my own to France for 3 months at the age of 11 to stay with the family, which initially was predictably hell on earth. And after the first week, I was deeply, madly in love with France, a love affair that has never ended. So I suppose I was exposed to a lot of travel quite young. But I think I was the gypsy in the family, because even though my brothers all travel all over the world and have all great, crazy careers, I was much more of a gypsy traveler. So things like, you know, I worked in a farm in Belize that ostensibly grew oranges, but shall we say, made most of their money out of a different crop.
Yes.
And that type of experience, that's the kind of thing I was doing from very, very young. I suppose I've always had, my mother said that when I was able to crawl, I started trying to climb the walls to see what was outside our garden.
Amazing. That's wonderful. There's quite the backstory. I think we could probably fill an episode. I want to talk to you more about being thrown into a cell, but I fear that we'll go off point. In terms of business and having that fascination with both people and then understanding the business functions, at what point, and I'm very aware that it might be still yet to happen, have you considered marketing as a function being comparable to the function of finance? Because one of the reasons we brought you on is myself and three other people here within the agency have all taken the mini MBA in management, and we all really enjoyed both the modules that you taught. And it struck us that the language of finance is such a key thing that is lacking in our industry. And I think if the industry is going to be taken more seriously, which I think it should do, then we need to understand how to talk properly to CFOs and talk the language of business.
So you're touching on something that you mentioned yourself at the beginning of this episode, which is, you know, one of my very simple advice to marketeers. And I was that person. I felt intimidated by the language. And if I'm honest, I just felt very disinterested in the entire topic of finance until I started realizing that I was framing it wrongly in my head. So instead of thinking about this as finance, think of it as this is like how we make all our commercial decisions. And do we have the cash to actually make them happen? It's really important. Your business fails very quickly if people are making poor commercial decisions. And one of my really strong philosophies is you can't leave commercial decision-making to finance people. Shooting myself in the foot there, but nonetheless, good commercial decision-making has to be cross-functional. So people need to be able to talk to each other. So some of it is definitely that marketing people need to understand the language. Some of it is don't let yourself be intimidated by the numbers. That's not what it's about. It's about simply making better decisions. And the reality is, who understands decision-making better? Commercial people or pure finance people? And the answer in my experience is absolutely consistently commercial people. The way I frame it is it's much easier to teach a marketing person to understand enough about finance to get their ideas across at top management level, at board level, than teaching a finance person to understand marketing. So if anybody's going to cross that bridge, and I've basically positioned my career on that bridge between finance and the other functions, and probably most of my audiences are marketeers. So I'm running a big program at the moment for, let's just say, one of the biggest car companies in the world, if not the biggest, and 90% of my audience at senior management level are marketeers. That's my world. I live on that bridge.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The people who will cross that bridge are more likely to be marketing people learning how to communicate with the finance people than the finance people learning how to communicate with the marketing people. To put it at its simplest, you know, building brand equity goes in one ear and out the other ear of a finance person. Building shareholder value grabs our attention immediately. And the structure that we used on the mini MBA for the finance piece was less about pumping numbers and Excel spreadsheets at you. It was more about understanding, look, what's finance trying to achieve? And what's at board level? What are the board responsible for doing? And their main responsibility is creating value for the shareholders without too much risk. And once you understand that simple point, like what's their goalpost? They're shooting the ball into a goal. That's their goal. And then you learn to express what you're proposing to do. So, you know, building brand equity, why does it matter? It matters because it links to building shareholder value in the following way. So learning to link everything that you do to the buttons that get the ball into their goalpost, that's all you need to do. It's not rocket science. And marketeers are much better at learning other people's languages than finance people are, because you're natural communicators. So getting inside their heads, empathizing with, you know, why are they so stressed about funding this particular marketing campaign? Like, what's going on? Understanding, for example, bigger picture, what are the financial pressures on the company at the moment? You know, how well are we doing? And if we're not doing so well in the stock market, well, why are we not doing so well in the stock market? And what would we need to improve and change to up our position on the stock market? And therefore knowing, well, if you're sitting across the table for the CFO and he just got a beating at a presentation to the City of London, understanding that is going to get you an awful long way.
Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
My first sort of proper paid weekly job was a holiday job as a student, which was driving a forklift truck at the Ribena factory.
Ah, Call to Action, episode 11, with the one and only Rory Sutherland. Not what we were looking for, but hang on a minute. Ah, there we go.
There were lots of quotes we could have chosen in your introduction, but the one we chose ends with, use your marketing hat to understand your stakeholder. I find it quite fascinating that there seems to be a disconnect, or, you know, not always, but there is commonly a disconnect between the two departments and functions, given that marketers exist to understand a segment of people and communicate as effectively as possible to them. Are there any other tips you can give to the marketers listening of how else they can do that? Are there any common things that come up in your teaching?
The first of all is to just don't be scared of violence. And an awful lot of that, I think, is because people perceive it as a discipline where you're spending your life looking at lots of grey spreadsheets. And that's not true. We had a fantastic discussion at the Festival of Marketing around why CMOs relatively rarely become CEO. And I think that discussion crystallized a lot of these points. And there's endless analysis of that particular debate all over the internet. At one point that predictably comes up repeatedly is that one of the gaps that a lot of CMOs have is an understanding of finance. And it's not realistic for a CMO to go back and spend, you know, 2 years studying finance. That's not going to happen. So what we tried to do on the mini MBA was go, well, let's assume they have 3 hours to watch some kind of fun films. And we spent a huge amount of work trying to make sure that those 3 hours of film footage really give them a roadmap of understanding, like, what's finance all about? And for you as a marketeer, what do you need to be able to do as simply as possible? So the first obvious one is find a fairly kind of fun, painless way of getting your head around, what is it that I don't know about finance that I should know as a marketeer? The second point I would make is just be careful about the job that you, be careful about career management as a marketeer. And again, an interesting piece of research I read was the whole question of what's the definition of a CMO? Like, what does a CMO actually do? And the range is drastic from a very narrowly defined role where you are effectively just, to be facetious, looking at pretty pictures, all the way through to a role where you're genuinely, you may not even be called CMO anymore. You may have a title of Chief Growth Officer or something similarly, slightly pretentious. But the point being, and the difference being, if you're, for example, working in a retail chain as a CMO in a very narrow role, where all you're effectively responsible for doing is running promotional campaigns, running ad campaigns, and the only language you can really use is building brand awareness and building brand equity, it becomes quite difficult to step outside that role and really engage with the CFO. Whereas if you're given a wider mandate in an industry like that, as standing back from it, what are marketing actually supposed to do? Well, they're supposed to grow sales, so far so good. But also reframing that and saying, well, we'd really like them to grow profit, not just sales. And now if you're chief growth officer in a retail chain, for example, you should have a much wider mandate that includes everything from, do we have the right products on shelf? Is our product portfolio management fit for purpose? All the way through to, are we innovating appropriately? And do we have our retail outlets in the right place? So you could get involved in property portfolio management, you could get involved in innovation projects. So you'll have a much wider range of responsibility. And once you get that wider range of responsibility, you will automatically be exposed to decisions that go way beyond just should we or should we not run this campaign. And you'll inevitably start being engaged in conversations around money, frankly, much bigger conversations around money. So what's the rationale of changing our... One of my earliest jobs was taking on a chain of retail shops. We had 350 stores and about half of them were losing money. The whole company was losing money hand over fist. And I was part of a team that came in with private equity backing. And now you're suddenly making much, much bigger decisions that cost quite a bit of money, where you're interacting with all of the other teams and you're interacting a lot with finance. Once you get into that kind of role as a marketeer, your understanding of marketing allows you to add huge value to those decisions, but also become engaged in much more sophisticated conversations with the CFO. And that really builds your credibility. So I do think there's a career management piece to it as well, which is even before you accept the job, or you know, you've applied for a job, you're about to be signed up, making sure that your role is as broad as possible, or if you're already in a role. So for example, I only got lucky in GM because I volunteered out of my pretty boring routine job to take on a slightly unstructured, random project that came up because of a problem in the Greek market. And that led immediately to a lot of crazy opportunities that brought me way outside finance. But as a marketeer, you could spend your whole life trapped in, you know, marketing is fun and it's glamorous and it's fantastic, don't get me wrong, but it depends on your aspirations. It'll be much harder to make the move into a very senior management position unless you've had that wider exposure. Again, I recognize that might not be for everybody because, you know, a lot of aspects of marketing that are great fun without going beyond running ad campaigns and promotions. But if you really want to even think about a CEO type job or a board type job, then make sure that you manage your career.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point. It's easy to kind of miss. And I don't want to lead the witness, but I can see what you're alluding to. There's nothing wrong with a CMO not wanting to become a CEO. And I would imagine the vast majority of CMOs out there, you know, probably have a hugely varying aspirations for their careers. The only one, funny enough, the only one that springs to mind is Rob Schwartz, who was obviously CMO and went to CEO of TBWA New York. But I think that path is maybe rarer than I would otherwise have hoped it would be.
Yeah, it's hard to pin it down. There are quite a few examples, but they're still the minority. And, you know, it's hard statistically to pin it down because if you Google, you know, how many CMOs become CEOs, you'll get about 20 different statistics. The internet is a fascinating place. But we nonetheless know anecdotally, I sit on a lot of boards. It depends a bit on the industry as well. So because I spent so long in the automotive industry and then as an investment banker, I was specializing in aviation, automotive and engineering. So I had the misfortune of spending a lot of my career in relatively low margin industries. And in low margin industries, the board is completely dominated by finance. And it's very difficult to make the move as a CMO into really senior positions unless you prove loud and clear that you can also completely engage with the numbers. Whereas in other industries, you know, I did do some work as a consultant in some wonderfully glamorous companies like Cartier and Gucci. And that's a completely different planet in terms of what you need to prove to get to the board. So I think there might also be, depending on your aspirations, that might also dictate what sort of industry you want to join. In a low margin industry, there just isn't a huge amount of budget for really cool marketing stuff. And if you can't engage with numbers, your career will be probably quite limited.
That's a really interesting point. I'd like you to unpack that a little more, if you don't mind. The point about there being little budgets available for interesting marketing. If marketing ultimately exists to improve the chances of commercial success, whether they do that through, I don't know, R&D, pricing, distribution, building equity, aka shareholder value. Why is that? Is that just the nature of low margin industries?
That one comes down to pure arithmetic. Now, you could argue that the car industry is an exception, but like mid-range cars are very low margin, but yet major car brands obviously spend money on marketing. And the car industry is a fascinating place at the moment because you have these legacy companies like GM and Stellantis, who now own most of the legacy brands. And they are still spending money on marketing, but they have very tight margins. And they're really scratching their heads over, you know, why aren't we creating shareholder value? Look at Tesla. So it's probably unfair to make a sweeping generalization that all low margin industries have weak marketing budgets. But in general, it's arithmetic. If you have margins, if you have a gross margin of 5%, that means that out of your 10 billion in sales, you've only got a very small sliver of money left to cover all of your staff costs and your marketing budget. So it just, as a sweeping generalization, the higher your margin, and you know it's clearly demonstrated by high branded products, your Dior's, et cetera, where the higher your margin, if you've got a 95% gross margin on your perfume or your Gucci designer glasses, by definition, you have much more room for maneuver to do really clever stuff when it comes to running marketing campaigns. So part of it's simply arithmetic and part of it's arguably cultural. And that's why I think the car industry is possibly a bit of an exception. Generally, companies with extremely strong, highly respected brands, very strong brand recognition, premium brands, will in general tend to have pretty healthy margins. Whereas in the car industry, some brands that are still fairly prestigious and have extremely strong recognition, etc., because of the nature of building a car, the margins are still quite weak. So you have this slightly challenging situation where you have to support the wonderful brand, but you don't have these 95% gross margins. You have tiny little margins, which makes it very challenging.
Yeah, I like, you caveated what you said there as being a sweeping generalization. I'm a big fan of sweeping generalizations. We're bound to get some audience engagement after the episode.
And I'm sure that there's people in the audience sitting there in companies with low margins thinking, but we do the most fantastic marketing campaigns that have ever been done on planet Earth. I do have the privilege as a consultant of probably working in any given year with probably 40 to 50 companies. And what that does give you is the ability to make sweeping generalizations because you build up a database in your head, not from research or from a book, but you build up a database in your head of watching not just, you know, can they afford to run major marketing campaigns in companies with low margins, but also the culture of companies with low margins versus the culture of companies with high margins. And they're two very different animals. So if you're in a company with a very low margin, for example, you will find that finance are a very dominant function. If you're in a company with an extremely high margin where it's all about prestige brand, finance, I'm not saying they're unimportant. We can't, you know, we still have to make money and we can't run out of money. But if you're running 95% gross margins and it's all about brand recognition and growing the brand, then marketing will be the dominant function. And the culture of those two company types is often completely different. A lot of my clients will, I'm lucky. I have worked for some of the big brands as well and continue to do so. But by definition, the companies where I tend to develop a really long-term engagement, sadly or otherwise, tend to be companies where finance is dominant, where therefore they tend to be needing a lot of outside help. Even, you know, I have companies with turnover in the 3 billion where they still need external consultancy advice in terms of changing things, making decisions quickly, repositioning the company, all of that kind of stuff. It's often puzzling to me that I have clients with turnover of 3 billion with finance teams in the hundreds and they're still looking for outside advice. And you can't help wondering, surely you have this massive finance team. But often the culture of a company of that type with a low margin can be very, very cautious because with low margins, you can't afford to make mistakes. You can go very quickly into a loss-making situation. And therefore, sometimes the culture of the people running the finance team may be more at that transactional bean counter end of the spectrum rather than what companies often need in this day and age. And again, I suppose the car industry is a fascinating example of that, that that industry is changing so fast as we move, like all the obvious moves from electric cars to driverless cars to shared ownership of cars and all of these things. We know they're all going to happen. We're not sure when when they happen, they're going to happen incredibly fast. You can't afford a culture in your finance function of slow moving decision making, bean counting,
I imagine in a low margin industry, so more, I suppose it's more commoditized, it's very much a volume game. Is that what you mean by it's just basic arithmetic? Because due to the nature of volume, the risk profile becomes so much, I don't know how you'd describe it. How would you describe it? Different? Severe?
Yeah, it's actually, some of it's relatively simple, and I watch this behavior regularly. And to give you a really simple example, you know, pricing in some companies, the marketing people will be all over it because pricing is a significant part of your brand messaging.
Sort of signaling of a brand as well.
Exactly. And if you're in a low margin industry, you will have finance breathing down your neck if you change your pricing by 2 cents. And that bit is, again, I would say relatively simple arithmetic, that if you've got a margin, and some of my companies would have margins as low in some industries, particularly in things like commodity food, et cetera, might have extremely low margins. But even taking mid-range cars, which frankly are relatively commoditized. I'll probably never get to work again in the car industry now that I've said that. But anyway, but you know, do we really actually agonize over the difference anymore? Because we know that they're all sharing components and we know they're all sharing engines and we know that they're actually all very, very similar. And if we're buying a car in that segment, you know what? We're probably very price sensitive and it's low margin. And in that world, it's very easy to go from a margin of plus 5% to a margin of minus 5% if you make minor mistakes. So you get this very, very all-invasive finance culture dominating every decision.
Can I ask what you think, at the risk of opening up a huge can of worms, our industry seems morbidly fascinated with what's happening at Jaguar. Do you think the average CFO gives two hoots as to the latest? Kind of,
you mean the
brand,
recent ad campaign or?
Yeah, just the kind of rebrand,
yeah,
hint that they've shared online in the last week or two. Or are you entirely removed from it? And if you are...
I know, don't worry. I've been avidly reading about it myself because, yeah, you know, one whole area that just, you know, what is it that fascinates me about business? And, you know, why did I suddenly think, oh, finance is actually really cool? And I know, you know, slight detour and I will come back to Jaguar. I think where I realized that finance was really cool was I realized that if I wore a little hat that said finance expert and had a business card that kind of somehow or other made me sound credible in finance, that I could make things happen in companies. And as a consultant, what I absolutely love doing is arriving in a company where I can see, look, you know, great product, great idea, really well positioned. Oh, shit, you're losing money hand over fist. OK, we can solve this because it's a great product. Once I know you have a great product, we can solve this. And I regularly come in and it's like a doll's house. You know, you take the company apart and you put it back together and you put it back together in a profitable way and you move on. So it's big commercial strategic decision-making that just completely fascinates me. And the area of strategic decision-making that is the most fascinating is when companies get it spectacularly wrong. Now, I know the jury is out at the moment on the Jaguar case, but looking at it as an outside non-marketing person, I think it'll be very interesting to watch the outcome of that particular ad campaign. Like, there's so many things to me that look incredibly poorly judged about it. I mean, apart from the obvious, like, where are the cars? But the, you know, the patronizing attempt to bring in the usual buzzwords of diversity, etc., in the context of a car like Jaguar in a world where such a huge percentage of the population are still reeling from shock from horrific inflation over the last 3 years, barely able to put food on the table. I think there's a fundamental lack of sensitivity to that ad because that kind of weird combination of the diversity of the profile of the people in the imagery with the reality of the people who buy Jaguar cars.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite interesting to see that it's happening, is kind of happening over a timeline, obviously, because at some stage we'll see the results of all their R&D and ultimately the product will have a decisive factor in their success. When I think of what finance department or a classic CFO might be making of, you know, marketers losing their shit, if you will, on LinkedIn about it, I have this vivid image of Logan Roy from Succession. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Succession.
Oh, but
it's amazing. And that part where he addresses his children and says, I love you, but you are not serious people. I just have that in my mind now when I think of finance looking at marketing. Do you think marketing has a relatively good reputation in the eyes of the C-suite?
You know, I know it's a cliche, but it's probably still true. And I think, unfortunately, you're in a way talking to the wrong person because I am the exception to prove the rule. partly because I work so intensely with marketing people all the time, and therefore I have deep, deep, deep respect. I also came from a marketing background, and I very much see things from that side. In other words, I see finance as a means to implement really cool marketing decisions, not the other way around. I think a lot of finance people, unless they've developed a much broader, meaningful vision as a finance person, see marketing as a cost center, as in, and see them almost as children who will simply blow their budget unless I keep on top of them like a ton of bricks. I think that is, albeit cliched, still a common attitude in finance. And a lot of the work that we do, some of my work in Europe at the moment is about trying to really change that mindset. So I run, for example, like a massive game where you're running a startup from scratch, and it's a team game, and you're covering obviously marketing, R&D, et cetera, et cetera. And the one thing that comes out of the game, it's an utterly fascinating, we play it in a castle in northern France, in a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere, and it's insanely immersive for 3 whole days. And it's about building shareholder value. And it's a really well-designed game because it's both relatively easy to play, but incredibly strategic. And what comes out over and over and over in terms of the learning, like, yeah, they learn how to build shareholder value and they learn a bit about financial statements, et cetera, but that's not what we're really trying to achieve. What we're really trying to achieve is getting people to see the world from the perspective of the other functions. So you'll get kind of and these are really senior people, like, you know, the continent manager of R&D for major cosmetic brand in one of our clients is one of the biggest cosmetic brands in the planet, through to some of the biggest food companies in the planet, some of the biggest technology companies in the planet, you know, household names, GE, Dell, etc. And the feedback would be things like, yeah, initially I was looking at the decisions all the time with my R&D hat on, and then I realized you can't do that. That you have to actually understand how to look at these decisions as a marketing person, a finance person. Otherwise, you're making screwed up decisions all the time. And I think a lot of finance people, all the way through to CFO, might need a bit of a jolt and some kind of a deep transformational experience to see that they really need to understand the world from the marketing perspective too. And it's funny, we talked earlier about the bridge. And even in the mini MBA, I remember thinking that we're placing a lot of pressure all the time in training on asking the marketing people to walk over the bridge towards finance. In other words, the marketing people need to fill the gaps in their understanding of finance. The marketing people need to learn to speak the language of finance. So all the time, the pressure is placed on the other side of that bridge. And I don't think there's enough pressure, frankly, placed on the CFO to learn to speak the language of marketing, learn to speak the language of operations. You, my dear CFO, should also be well able to articulate why brand equity obviously drives shareholder value. Like, you should be able to do that. But I'd say as a profession, they're still not there in most cases, with some stellar exceptions. I run a program for developing CFOs. And a lot of what we're trying to do is precisely this whole piece of widening their perspective radically beyond just running a finance team and making sure the company doesn't run out of cash. A lot of it is about completely shifting their mindset into seeing the world from other perspectives. I played that particular game recently with a large, well-known company, I won't say who, and one of their most senior finance people was part of the game. And he turned around to me, his team was losing spectacularly, and they weren't creating any shareholder value whatsoever. And he turned around to me one of the coffee breaks and he said, "Well, if I was playing on my own, we'd be winning." And I thought that says everything I could possibly say about where the finance function needs to learn to look at itself too.
Yeah. Amazing. I want to play that game now.
To be honest, it's great fun.
Sounds it.
You can come over to our little castle in France with our Michelin starred chefs. And
is there such a thing as a little castle?
It's actually huge. It's only about 800 acres or something, in the absolute middle of nowhere. Though it's definitely my favourite piece of work at the moment.
Oh, it sounds amazing. I'm mindful of time. I think I'm going to have to go to listener questions. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. We've had a few in. I'm going to start with Alistair. So Alistair Thompson. So Alistair has asked, given that finance functions, by and large, analyze factual information from the past, and marketers, by and large, make decisions about the future without all the facts they would ideally like to have to hand, how do you tackle helping finance teams understand the risk-reward payoff if they are in control of the budgets and need proof before they'll release the cash?
Okay, so first of all, I would disagree with him that finance spend most of their time dealing with historic fact. And there's two reasons I disagree with that. The first is, I presume what he's referring to there is that finance people are dealing a lot with historic accounts, as in historic financial statements.
Yes, so I suppose.
We're dealing with historic P&Ls, and we're dealing with historic balance sheets. And first of all, and this was a bit of a shock to me when I came into finance from a background in pure mathematics, which is, you know, genuinely quite factual and quite pure and quite logical. And I arrived into finance and I didn't realize until then that financial statements are actually just a subjective interpretation of what we think happened last year. That is the biggest shock. When I teach people the basics of how financial statements work, and you realize that every time you reflect something like, we spent money on market research, for example, how you interpret that simple fact in a set of financial statements is subjective because you have multiple ways of reflecting it. So first of all, the so-called objective history, I don't think is true. But secondly, looking at historical data is only a tiny part of what finance people do. 90% of a modern finance CFO's time, and this is, I don't read many textbooks anymore, but I read a huge amount of research on what's changing in financial management, what modern best-in-class CFOs do, what modern best-in-class finance functions do. And a lot of it is very kind of hands-on practitioner research from people like McKinsey. And they look at things like, what do the CFOs of the most successful companies in the world actually do? What do the finance teams, where do they spend their time? And the research is loud and clear. They spend a tiny percentage of their time on historic record keeping, i.e. creating historic financial statements, because most of that in the modern world can be automated. AI is hugely helpful, et cetera, et cetera. Where they really spend their time is driving the future, creating the shareholder value, making decisions for the future. The problem with making decisions for the future is that you make the decision based on a forecast. In other words, you know, if I enter the North Korean market, what will happen? How many units will I sell, et cetera, et cetera? And this is where it's not about kind of, oh, marketing people just look at the future and we look at the past. This is where, like, we really need to look together. And I think there's a grow up moment for both sides, which is if you're making a decision such as entering a completely new geographic market that you've never been in before, launching a completely new product, or even more riskily, entering a completely new business segment that you've never been in before, this has to be a tightly collaborative exercise between marketing and finance. And first of all, finance need to fully realize that we're completely dependent on the marketing people for the deep understanding of the North Korean market. Our job is to query, to probe, where exactly are you coming out with that number from? What's your research based on? And it's up to the marketing people to be as honest as possible. So in other words, I often, when I'm teaching marketing people, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, when I'm pitching to the CFO to try and get my idea across the line, should I show like amazing projections for, you know, what happens if I run this ad campaign, and should I show really, really positive projections? And the answer is no. Like, you should be as honest as possible, and you should show what you genuinely think is going to happen, the basis for what you genuinely think is going to happen, and then show the upside, downside. In other words, you should be as honest as possible about the risks of running the campaign. You shouldn't be treating them as if it was a them and us conversation. It should be a collaborative conversation. So it's not easy. Like most of my work, I don't get involved anymore at all in producing or creating historic financial data. Not my world. My world is building companies. So I work, my consultancy work is nearly all with very high growth companies. Sometimes I meet them at the idea stage. in some cases, I'm still with them when they're at the 900 million turnover stage. And everything we're doing is about the future. Every single solitary decision we make in terms of developing platform, developing our revenue proposition to the customer, everything is about how do we think customers will respond if we do X, Y, Z. And it's a collaboration. And it's not easy because we don't have a crystal ball. So all you can do is you make assumptions about the future and then you go over and over, okay, is there anything we can do to get better data, to get better research about how customers will respond? And obviously, you know, you do the usual stuff. You do focus groups with your customers. You go looking for information, like you do deep dive analysis of your competition, try and figure out why your competition has done well or badly, as the case may be. But I think the fundamental difference where I'd be coming from in terms of that question is it's posed very much as a them and us. It shouldn't be like that. It should be just us.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I think it's very easy for departments to become very much us and them. And, you know, I suppose looking back at the episodes we've recorded over the last coming up to 6 years, it's normally a marketing, sales, us and them kind of perception. But yeah, we don't need any more us and them. Great answer. Question two is from Paul McFarlane, who's a US-based advertising brain, very creative chap. He's asked, why does creative advertising cost less? I assume he's talking about creative effectiveness and like how finance understand the value of creativity.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I understand his question, if I'm perfectly honest.
No.
It was a bit of a curveball. I think possibly my interpretation of his question would be that if you really put brilliant creativity into an ad, the probability is that for a much smaller budget, you will have much greater impact. And, you know, we all know that in terms of how we respond to ads, except that every so often you get these incredibly creative, quirky ads and you're still left wondering at the end of the ad, sorry, what was the product? Who was the company? But assuming that you solved those problems, you know, we all know how we have responded in the past to brilliant, clever advertising or other marketing promotional tools. Does it necessarily cost less? No, but I think it's more cost effective because it's going to leave a much longer impact on people's brains. So I presume that's where he's coming from.
Yeah, I think so. It's greater value.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't think that in finance we try to cost cut on ad campaigns by saying like, oh, just go and spend more money and be more creative. Because I don't think... Now, I know Helen did a brilliant session on being more creative in your approach to advertising during the Festival of Marketing, and I loved it. But I think part of the point that she was making is, you know, you can't just decide to be creative. It's not that simple. So if finance come out with something really simple like, oh, reduce your marketing budget by 40% and be more creative, that will definitely be a vicious self-fulfilling prophecy of not being creative.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Moira, the final part of the interview then is our four pertinent poses. Starting with, and we touched on this earlier, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Yeah, this was one of the questions I found the hardest because my younger self was so chaotic. I'm not even sure where to begin.
She was described as unemployable, I forgot to mention earlier.
Yes, I do remember when I went for the job in GM after kind of a period of chaos in my life, but, you know, brand spanking new MBA, but in debt up to my eyeballs. And I desperately needed a job. And I'll never forget the response to the wonderful man who subsequently became a great mentor and brought me through several companies after GM as a consultant. But he leaned over the table with my CV in front of him and said, look, you're not going to get a job because you're clearly completely unemployable. I've read your CV. But I just thought you sounded so interesting. I wanted to meet you. And after an hour and a half of great conversation, he said, okay, I need to get you through the HR people, but I think you're in. But my younger self was definitely pretty chaotic. And I don't frankly regret that. I'm quite glad that I did just about loads of crazy shit in my 20s. The only thing I wish I could transfer, and, you know, my own kids laugh at me when I try to do this with them, which is you can't put an old head on young shoulders. It's just not physically possible. But I wish I had had a much clearer sense of what matters, because I'm at a stage in life now where I keep that really clear in my head. I have a really clear sense of prioritization when I'm making decisions. I've the simplest possible structure for making decisions in my head in terms of prioritization. And, you know, my health comes first, followed by my family, which surprises some people, but you're no use to your family unless you're healthy. And I'm lucky we're all wonderfully healthy. But it's about focusing on stuff that really matters to you. The problem is, I'm not sure that you can work out what matters to you without going through quite a kind of chaotic, messy phase and making lots of mistakes first. But I have found that being crystal clear, you know, for example, I drive a complete banger. I'm obsessed with adventure sports. I spend all of my money on sports kit. And as far as I'm concerned, my car is purely a device that gets my multiple kayaks and surf skis and so forth from A to B. And therefore, things like I don't give a shit if people see me rocking up in a banger. I don't give a shit what effect that has on their perception of me. Whereas back in the day, I might have wasted time thinking like, oh, I'm supposed to be a financial consultant. And I do remember way back when I set up my business, cycling to a client and thinking, well, should I be doing this? Because their perception of a financial consultant, you shouldn't be rocking up on a bicycle. And walking in, and this was 20 years ago, Ireland was still very much in transition from a world where if you were a financial consultant, you wore a grey suit, you were male, and you probably drove a Lexus. And I walked in thinking like, maybe I should have driven. And, you know, my husband had a semi-respectable car. Maybe I should have borrowed his car. And I remember getting a surge of relief when my client just went like, wow, that's really cool. You're obviously really fit. And thinking, yes, Ireland is finally changing. But that sense of knowing what matters to you and simply ignoring stuff that doesn't matter to you but matters to the outside world, I wish I'd had that clarity when I was younger.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant advice. Really good. I don't think we certainly hadn't had that exactly as you've articulated it before. And that's makes it doubly refreshing. I've got images of you turning up on a rally burner BMX, and I hope you don't spoil that. That what clearly.
I remember one of the best openings to a meeting I had around that time, and I had just gone independent as a consultant, and it's quite nerve wracking initially because until then I've been working for places like the World Bank and one of the biggest investment banks in London and General Motors. Once I came through the chaotic period of my life, I was straight into that kind of big corporate, and I had that badge, and therefore you didn't feel exposed as a little human being. You know, it's just me, and I was still literally probably 2 months into running my consulting business completely independently with no background brand. And I got a phone call from a big client, a large corporate client, and needed corporate finance, some really interesting corporate finance work. And I remember thinking again, do I put the good old investment banking pinstripe suit back on or not? And I decided, no, look, this is it. I'm going as me. And I walked in, and he looked at me with surprise when I walked in, kind of not quite in a pair of jeans, but nonetheless looking fairly relaxed. And I thought he was kind of mentally commenting on the fact that I didn't look like a corporate banker. And he said, I'm really disappointed. And I said, why? And he said, because I thought you'd abseil in the office window. I looked up the line. All I could see, you're a complete lunatic. All I could see is photographs of you ice climbing. I thought the least you was arrive on a rope.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Amazing. Number two, Moira, if you could banish one thing from your industry, what would it be and why?
I saw this question asked before, and I was wondering, in my case, you're possibly thinking more of financial services than finance in the wider sense. The financial services industry, once I escaped from investment banking, I decided I was never going to go back to that world. I find the financial services industry, i.e., you know, banking and everything that is associated with banking, in general, incredibly arrogant and unnecessarily cutthroat. It was a very unpleasant place to be quite blunt. I don't think I've ever been anywhere. When I was an investment banker, the world that I was moving in was so far from my own personal values, it was almost surreal. I think the wider finance community, if I were to try and change one thing, it's more about their either incapacity or unwillingness, I'm never sure which, to communicate in plain English. So that inability to, I often sit at meetings, and because I've now been working in corporate finance for more decades than I'm prepared to admit, and because I'm professor of finance in two extremely respected international business schools in INSEAD and Warwick Business School, I have the privilege of being able to call bullshit. And I often sit at meetings and Mr. or Mrs. CFO, I'm afraid both genders are guilty, will be talking absolute bullshit in completely hidden in complex jargon. And I've often had to kind of lean across the table, and there'll be other people sitting in the room, obviously completely disengaged because they've no idea what this means. And I know it's just total bullshit. And I've often had to lean across the table and basically go, look, either I'm stupid or you're talking bullshit. Can you explain this in English, please? And you get two responses. Obviously, you get complete shock on the face of the CFO person, and you get a look of relief and joy on the face of everybody else in the room. And I do think it's an extremely frequent problem. Obviously, you know, I work, thank God, with some utterly amazing CFOs as well, who are brilliant communicators and in every possible sense, but they are the exception.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, it's a common problem. I think that problem kind of crosses into all sorts of industries, right?
We all hide behind our jargon. And I often joke that, you know, like everybody else, finance people hide behind our jargon. And part of it is just because if people realized how relatively simple finance actually is, we wouldn't earn as much as we do.
Yeah, well, I think they're the truth in that too, for sure. Number three, are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, this is my least favorite question because kind of shock horror at this stage in my career. I don't think I've read a finance textbook in about 20 years.
These needn't be industry related, but they obviously can be.
What I am kind of fascinated by is the way finance really impacts people's lives. And one of the things that kind of really changed it for me was some of the people that taught me on my MBA program. We had the main advisor to Franco, who convinced Frank, the dictator Franco in Spain, to abandon the autarky system in Spain. We had the guy who oversaw the reunification, the monetary reunification between West Germany and East Germany. We had one of the main economic advisors to Thatcher. So we had people who had really deep experience of making massive financial decisions on that kind of national level, you know, finance slash economics, but in a lot of cases also very much finance monetary decisions. And what fascinated me was the impact it has on people's lives. So I love, insofar as I read about finance at all, it's more about how it impacts actual real people. And one of my favorite books still, and it's very much a kind of a big sweeping generalization type book, but The Ascent of Money is well worth reading to get an understanding of, and there's a lot of debate, like do finance and economics drive history or does history drive finance and economics? And I think The Ascent of Money does an incredibly good job of tracking back things like what caused the French Revolution. There was a massive crash just before the French Revolution, all the way through to the 20th century in terms of like the effect of the late 20s crash on what happened in the following decade in terms of going back into World War II, etc. And I think that interrelationship between politics and finance slash economics, it's one of the reasons I started to find finance fascinating. And if you look even at the moment at the political instability we're experiencing worldwide, I'm not saying it's the only cause, but certainly quite a significant amount of it was triggered by what happened in 2008 in the Great Recession, and the reality that a lot of people are still suffering from huge levels of debt, joblessness, a lot of people lost their homes. So that kind of illusion that probably prevailed up until 2008, that life was getting better, and then a huge number of people are left quite disenfranchised after that in really dire financial situations, and then you throw the recent inflation into it. But that just, I think Ferguson does a very, very good job in that book. So if I were to read, as a non-finance person, if I were to read one book, it's not really about finance, it's about money, but obviously the two are tightly linked, to put it mildly. And I think it really brings it down to the human level. Really easy to read.
Yeah, well, I'm confident saying that book's not come up before as well, which is increasingly rare. So that's brilliant. And then number four, Moira, is we always dedicate every episode to somebody, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give their reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
Well, I think I'm very lucky. I have a fantastic partner and family, but everybody probably dedicates to their mammy. So I'm not going to do that. Tempted to dedicate to my husband, because otherwise I definitely wouldn't keep it together, but I won't do that either. I thought about this one long and hard. And when I moved into finance, I came from a very clueless background, and I was probably less confident than a lot of my cohort at the time, who had come into quite a senior job in GM in my late 20s. I felt I had very little experience. I had two absolutely fantastic mentors. And one was Gail Gunderson, who died prematurely the year I left GM, which made it particularly poignant. And apart from the fact that he was consistently incredibly kind, I remember he was madly into donkeys. He ran a little kind of private donkey sanctuary we were all living in Germany at the time. And, you know, he had that really clear sense of prioritizations. And I remember it's one of the first times I saw that real clarity, where his family and his donkeys were definitely his top priority. But he was also brilliant. He was global vice president for finance for GM at the time for everything outside North America. But the reason I remember him so clearly and the reason I quote him so regularly is because he had zero tolerance for bullshit. So he completely broke the mold of what I thought a finance person would be, to the point where, you know, I remember sitting at meetings where he would literally look, we'd all be kind of sitting trying to look intelligent, looking at a sheet of numbers. And Gail, as by far the most senior person in the room, would look at everybody and go, I don't know about anybody else, but this is total bullshit. And that was so refreshing back then. I often feel I learned just about everything I know in the period that I worked with him.
Fantastic. Okay, well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Gail Gunderson. Wonderful. I think everyone needs that in their life, is a permission to call out the bullshit at the earliest stage possible. Amazing. Thank you, Moira. So as a final call to action, we're going to link to everything we've discussed, including the ascent of money. We'll link to your profile, which exists on numerous websites, Moira, from the mini MBA programs to the universities and other establishments you are active at and associated with. But how else can our listeners get more Moira Creedon?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, my website at the moment, partly because we're not all that interested in marketing anymore because we've more work. I have a small team of people working for me on the consultancy side. So my website's pretty crap at the moment, so I'm not going to send it to the website. I'd say click on any of those profiles, including my LinkedIn profile. You know, I still obviously do speak mostly all over Europe rather than all over the world these days, but it's nearly always corporate events rather than publicly available events. But I'm obviously delighted if anybody wants to bounce a challenging question off me, contact me on LinkedIn. And if I can help in any way, I'd be delighted to hear from you.
Fantastic. Well, we'll include Moira's LinkedIn profile link in the listing too. So that should be easy to find if you're listening to this now. Moira, it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed this massively. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're a brilliant interviewer.
Lies.
I now give compliments to my interviewer.
Lies. Okay. Yeah, of course you are. Of course you are. Always welcome. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share it and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email the mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
Can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action. But I try, and I try, and I try.